head of the driven element is the first director. And these are rough approximations. You could not zero the frequency in with accuracy. In other words, with that technique, you couldn't tell the difference between a 425 meg Yagi and a 432 meg Yagi. The only way I know for sure that you could really find out what frequency it was tuned to is to take all of the lengths and positions of all the elements and their diameters, go to a modeling program and have the modeling program plot gain versus frequency, or to really set the antenna up on a stand and measure its gain versus frequency. You got to be careful, though, when you do that, you're not being fooled by the standing wave ratio of the driven element. Standing wave ratio of the driven element is a secondary effect. The primary effect is the way the director string of, in your case, the 28 elements, the 26 directors, those 26 directors have an exact frequency at which they're really tuned to, so to speak. So either by modeling or a real measurement is the only way you're really going to find out what frequency it was tuned to. Did somebody give you this antenna of a mysterious origin so you don't know what frequency it was made for? In the case of a 28-element antenna, very few services other than the ham radio operator would tolerate a 21-foot-long boom on 2 meters. Sounds to me like this was built for a ham radio operation. I said 2 meters, I meant 432. Sounds to me like it's a ham radio operation, quite possibly, Joe. Go ahead.
It was used for point-to-point link at a distance of about 75 miles on UHF, and it required very, very high gain from one location to the other. That's why the guy ended up buying this antenna. It was being used in the frequency range of 421 and 424 megahertz.
Okay. How about that? Point-to-point, and I think you're saying it was a ham radio operation. Okay. Did I hear you say you've got a pair of these antennas, Joe?
Yes, I do.
Interesting. And mechanically, they're strong enough to be 21 feet long and support themselves in a reasonable amount of wind, and so you'd like to use them. Okay. And you know how difficult it's going to be to get them onto the new frequency with any real significant performance. Not an easy job. Unless you, let me think now. I think it's either Directive Systems, which is the K1WHS, Dave O'Lean, K1 Whiskey, Hotel Sierra. I think he has a 28-element Yagi on 21 feet of boom on 432. Simply modify the design to copy his exact design. He's a nice enough guy. He'll tell you the element lengths and positions. That's one approach. Who else had a very long Yagi? Some of the designs by K1FO, K1 Far Out, Steve Polishin. He's probably got a design for a 28-element Yagi. So by way of one of the known good high-performance designs that currently exists, I'm beginning to think the least amount of man-hours of labor in your case would be to simply modify the antenna to copy one of those designs. Over to you for a comment on that, Joe.
Well, I guess that's what I'm going to have to do. Let me write that guy's call letters down again.
The guy who's got a bunch of published articles on Yagi designs is K1FO, K1 Far Out, Steve Polishin. But the guy who runs the company that sells the antennas is K1WHS, K1 Whiskey Hotel Sierra. That's Dave O'Lean in Lebanon, Maine. And he owns a company called Directive Systems. And my guess is you can find his website by just simply going to directivesystems.com or K1WHS. One way or the other, you'll get to Dave O'Lean. Over to you, Joe, for any fill.
Okay, this is what I have to do. I didn't really want to modify this thing to actually ruin it from where it came from, because it's kind of a shame to take an antenna that's built to one frequency and move it elsewhere. But the problem is, I can't find an antenna that works from 430 to 450, more closer to 435 to 440, which I intend to use these things. I found quite a few antennas of like 7-element design, 8-element, 9-element design, something like that. They go either 406 to 430 or 450 to 470, and the companies just don't make antennas in between anymore.
They do try pushcraft antennas.
I don't think Cushgrip goes anywhere near that big. There's one other company that might do it. I can't think of the name of them right now. But those two sources that I mentioned to you, I think are your best bets. Okay, Mel, what kind of mail have we gotten this week, and what do you recommend we get into? K2RIW.
Just push clear.
They have 19 elements speaking.
Okay, very good. This is K2KY.
Okay, Alex just told her they do have a 19 element job. That's getting kind of close. Although many of the Cushcraft designs, though, don't have anywhere near the performance of those other companies. Go ahead, Mel.
Then, tonight at 8 o'clock, W2VL repeater system.
Okay, make sure I have it. All right, very good, Dick. This is K2KEY. Looking through some interesting, got a tremendous amount of mail, especially on these antenna problems of people living in some unusual situations and what they're doing. I think we sort of brought them all out indirectly to try to tell us their solutions and their problems. Some which just problems, I suppose. We'll have to get together people that have similar problems with people that have solved similar problems. This is very complicated. I'm just looking through. Here's something that's very interesting. Question asked, some parts of the sky, I understand, are noisier and then others due to the presence of noise source, but the noise figure of a receiver should be low enough that the system of galactic noise should be of no problem. Is it a problem? Do I have to worry about galactic noises at 10 meters and 6 meters? Is it a factor? That's a good question. Go ahead, Dick.
I think the answer is a hard no. In the case of 6 meters and 10 meters, the amount of noise you get for that signal going through the ionosphere is quite significant. The amount of ionospheric interference, let's say, is quite significant. By the time you get to 432 and 1296, the galactic noise does make a difference. If you do enough searching for the recommended times of the year that you should be attempting to do moon bounce on 432 and 1296, you go to a good enough reference, you'll find out two or three things or factors. Number one, the orbit of the moon around the Earth is slightly elliptical. Therefore, the times of the month when the moon is closer to the Earth, perigee, and times when the moon is further from the Earth, apogee. And I think there's a good dB of difference in the echo power you get at perigee versus apogee. So choosing the right time of the month when the moon is closest, that helps you. Second of all, depending on the time of year, your antenna that's aimed at the moon either is or is not aimed at the center of our galaxy. The center of our galaxy is the very first extraterrestrial noise source that was ever discovered. It was discovered by Carl Jansky at Bell Laboratories in 1932. The Jansky unit is named after Carl Jansky. And so the report he was getting in those days is that the shortwave long range, but shortwave radio broadcasts were occasionally seeing a small amount of noise, and what is the way we came from? He built this spherical rotatable array, this great big antenna that he built on a bunch of orbital fields, rotatable, and by the actual physical object, it got transported to the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank, West Virginia. And I guess this thing is a healthy 20 feet wide and rotatable. So with an antenna of that much gain in directivity, he was able to discover which direction was the strongest noise coming from, and he watched that direction shift approximately 1 degree per day as the Earth was rotating a repeater.
Time out.
That direction of arrival was changing approximately 1 degree per day as the Earth was circulating around the sun. So the very first radio astronomy measurement where external noise outside of the Earth was ever measured was called Chamsky in 1932. Kind of amazing that the first measurement wasn't the sun. The sun wasn't measured until 1944, and that was done during World War II and kept rather quiet for a whole bunch of reasons. You would think the sun would be much louder. So the center of our galaxy, which has got a bunch of supermassive black holes and a whole bunch of material falling into them, is generating a significant amount of noise. If you go to the John Krauss books on radio astronomy, in fact, one of his books has that exact title, Radio Astronomy by John Krauss. He's got a bunch of maps of the sky as to how loud the radio noise is in various spatial directions in the center of our galaxy, which I think is the Cygnus X direction, Cygnus X source, or is it Cassiopeia A? I'm not sure which. Cass A or Cygnus X are the two loudest sources. So, if you're a serious moon bouncer on 432, certain times of the year, you'll have a little more advantage than others, because when you aim your antenna at the moon, you either are aiming it toward cold sky or not so cold sky, because the center of the galaxy is there. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. So, in other words, we would not actually be able to see much of galactic noise. Well, let's put it this way. Let's say right now with 10 meters being basically extremely quiet, would we be able to detect any of that galactic noise, Dick, by turning an antenna towards the sky? In other words, is there any kind of a detectable effect on a frequency, that lower frequency, over?
The answer, of course, is yes. Carl Jansky did it. I'm not sure of the exact frequency, but I think his antenna was operating somewhere around 15 megacycles. And with an antenna that is 20 feet wide, and I'm guessing that antenna, let me think now, I can calculate the number of wavelengths. 32 feet, 64 feet. 64 feet is a wavelength on 14 megacycles, if I got it right. Yeah, that's a full wavelength. So his antenna was a third of a wavelength wide. Kind of amazed that he was able to resolve that. If you got a really big high-gain antenna, and if you have a sensitive enough radio telescope receiver, can you detect the noise at the center of the galaxy? Absolutely. Your next question is it going to raise the noise power of your receiver 1S unit? No way. I think the noise power increase that he saw was something in the vicinity, if I had to pick a number, it was probably a number like 50 degrees Kelvin of increase on that particular receiver at 15 megacycles. That's a small fraction of the dB of the noise power you see out of an ordinary receiver operating at 10 meters or 6 meters. So, is it detectable? Yes. Is it significant? I say in most circumstances it's going to be quite insignificant. But by way of the sky map of radio astronomy measurements that were done by John Krauss, you go to Krauss's better material, and I've got a whole bunch of manuals that were printed by the National Radio Astronomy Observatory of their sky noise measurements at various frequencies. You could find out exactly how loud it's going to be. My gut feel is, unless he's doing a fairly significant science experiment in which he can resolve small fractions of a decibel. And by the way, a good radio telescope can resolve noise power from the outside universe, which is more than 20 decibels weaker than the noise created by the noise figure of your own receiver. A good radio telescope with a good integration factor can do that. That's not the usual kinds of electronics that we amateurs set up when we watch our signal strength meter on the receiver. So, I think it's not going to...
Repeater, time out.
So to repeat, as you can tell, I think it's not going to be very significant. But if you're willing to set up a real serious radio telescope, you can definitely measure it if you want to try hard enough. Over to you, Mel.
Okay, very good. Well, I'll tell you something interesting that's been going on. I've been, in fact, doing this for a while. I was on 20 meters today. I got on around 6 o'clock in the evening, finally got finished with a lot of things that let me sit down and relax a little bit, pretty deep. And what I do is I swing the beam where the background noise level is the highest. I open up everything on the receivers and shut off any of the noise of unity circuits or whatever. And I just listen. I move the beam, and I notice just as the sun begins to set, as I'm going sort of towards the south with the noise level is picking up. And I ran to a number of stations down there in the Caribbean. Then about around 6:30, I started moving the beam now and going westward. And again, looking at the noise level coming up, very, very, not very much. It's really quiet, the band, lately. And then I was hearing Japan for a while, around 6:30. There worked one guy in Japan, and the band sort of disappeared. But it seems like you can almost find where the band is opening right now towards the end, where possibly you can make a contact, is by just listening to the background noise stick on 20 meters over.
And that makes a lot of sense, though. I think an awful lot of the noise that you're seeing is man-made noise. It's going to peak up in certain directions, depending on where you live. Also, when the band is open, which means the ionosphere is reflecting the signal, not only is the ionosphere itself generating noise, but you're looking at multiple bounces of that signal in that direction over a lot of area of the Earth. And therefore, it is possible that one of those bounces is in the vicinity of a very large parking lot of a supermarket somewhere with a whole lot of fluorescent lighting. So what is the real source of the noise? Is it man-made or ionospheric? The answer is both. I'm not sure which is dominant. But yes, you will get a hint as to which direction the band is opening by extra noise. But occasionally you're going to be fooled, if you happen to have a noisy parking lot in your neighborhood. You may always peak in that particular direction. On 432, my antenna noise used to always peak in a particular direction, and I soon found out there was a 135 kilovolt loco transmission lines in that direction, and I was hearing the arcing of the corona discharge around the insulators on those high tension lines. K2KEY, K2RIW.
That's why you can only do it when conditions are very quiet and no man-made noise locally that would drown that out, because it is, I wouldn't say it, you know, it's very, very low, that noise. You can hear it in the background. And as I say, as the beam went south, then as the noise and the signal started to drop off, I tried following and repeating to see where I could get that so-called background noise back up, and I started getting going more and more west, and almost wound up more or less almost, close to north-northwest, and that's when I usually hear that part of the Pacific coming through just before the band goes out, and then goes quiet. Noise, everything just went flatline. It's amazing that this is the way conditions have been on HF now for a while. All the activity at this time of night, of course, moved over to 40, 80, and 160. Okay, just very interesting to think about, you know, well, really what's taking place, where we're really getting these noise sources from. But today, you'll live with it. All right, let me look for something else here.
KC2QAQ. Go ahead, Glenn.
Sorry, if I just had a quick comment about the Kushcraft beam for Joe.
Yeah, go right ahead. We heard a little bit of a buzzing noise in the background. You're running a charger?
No, I'm not. Is it still there?
The buzz went away. Was it a fluorescent light near your microphone?
No, there's a small connector on the back of my microphone. This is an MD-100, and my finger was touching it. Is it gone now?
The noise is gone now.
Okay, sorry about that. I just was going to mention for Joe, Kushcraft makes a 719B. It happens to be the antenna that I own, and I also own the 13B2. And just, you know, not talking about gain or getting really deep into this, I set mine up for between 430 and 450, and I tuned it there before I put it up, so it's tuned for a center. It used to be over about 1.2 at 440 megahertz. That's using the MFJ tuner, and inside the shack, I have an antenna tuner that allows me to actually get a really good match all the way down using the LMR 400 into the shack. But with my antenna tuner, I can tune all the way down to 420. Now, the funny thing is, on the sideband section, because I have it set up on horizontal, I've made contacts with 30 watts as far north as Maine into the southern sections of Canada, and as far south as Virginia, and as far west as PA on 440, which is 30 watts. So it's really not too bad an antenna, KC2QIQ.
And you really mean 440, meaning FM band, not 432, the sideband portion of the band. And your antenna is how many feet above the ground, Glenn?
Yeah, it's at the top of my homemade tubular tower. It's about 35 feet thick, and I have it fully rotatable with the rotator, and I'm just using that particular antenna in the horizontal direction, and very, very good performance with it. As I said, I can't tell you. I mean, they call it 15.5 dB a gain. I've never measured it. I really can't be sure, but for just with 30 watts, I was thinking of even getting an amplifier because I can hear actually better than a lot of other areas, but a lot of guys up there are well over 100 watts. And with 30, I've made contact, pretty much all over the place. So it's an antenna that I wouldn't be too afraid of, let's put it that way. But then again, mine is brand new, and I used my wheel bearing grease and lead grinding powder to assemble the antenna. But other than that, it seems to perform very well.
Yeah, when it comes to solid-state brick amplifiers, getting much above 100 watts is a little bit difficult without combining multiple purchased amplifiers. And if you want to get really serious on that band, it'd be nice to run closer to a kilowatt, in which case my strongest recommendation is 4CX250B tubes. I don't know what they're like lately, but in the past you got your biggest bang for your dollar out of those tubes on the surplus market. They used to sell for numbers like $10 a piece. And each one of them can put out 350 watts. A pair of them in a strip line kilowatt amplifier can easily put out 700 watts. Whereas the other tubes that you can buy these days that put out power on those frequencies are close to the $1,000 tubes. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, I don't think I really have to go that crazy. I mean, I think even with 100 watts, or a little bit more, I'd be very, very happy. Because my performance, even with 30 watts, it's really impressive. How far I've been able to go with this antenna. It shocks me every time I turn it on and have a little bit of time to go up onto that VHF end. And for a lot of people who like to get into DXing, I really don't want to go for the heavy, 20-meter beams and monstrous antennas. You don't really have to be all that huge of an antenna. I mean, these things aren't that large. I mean, the boom length, I think, is only like 13 feet. And, the elements are nice and short. They're only like 4 inches across for the, for the 440 band. 70 centimeters, and for the 2 meter its complement, it's about the same length and overall, but fantastic performance on the flat side if you want to put it up there and do a lot of sideband DXing in that area and without having a monstrous antenna array. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, something doesn't quite go together here. Yagi elements on the 430 band are roughly 12 inches wide. You said 4 inches. That would be 1296. I'm a little bit confused on that one. Second of all, you call it the 440 band. Are you talking to the 432 sideband people or the 440 FM people? Over to you, Glenn.
432 sideband, and I'm just trying to remember off the top of my head because it's been the summer when I put it up there. But I don't think it's quite that large across. I have the data sheet up here. Let me see if I can find what the element length is. I'll be right back.
Yeah, in 432, I think you're going to find directors are close to 12 inches long. Wavelength of 432 is 27 inches. Half wave would be in the vicinity of 12 inches. 4-inch element is 1296, Yagi. Okay, yeah. While waiting for Glenn to come back, Mel, go ahead with your next mailbag.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, quickie here. I had a number of inquiries about what we discussed last week, making the directional coupler that, if you remember, we discussed Tom, the heck was his last name, I have to remember. Oh, Tom McMullen. Yeah, Tom McMullen, W1SL, came up with that time, back What was it about?
Gee,
it was lost by 1970s, I remember. And where it is, where it appeared in QSC, you know, the step-by-step instructions of how to construct such a device for VHF and UHF. So I did some investigation. I found it was done. It drove me crazy because I couldn't seem to find what it was. It wasn't a directional coupler. It was under the line sampler. He called it the line sampler. And it was in April 1972 QSC, Dick, over.
And my article was also in the April and May issue, 1972. And I think I told you, when I first showed that parallel kilowatt amplifier to the people at AR Arola headquarters, while I was in that laboratory, I saw Tom McMullen's experiment on that directional sampler. He was doing that work right at that time. I guess I was there at the tail end of 1971, and the articles on both subjects appeared in 72. And my particular strip line amplifier was quite radical compared to the 71 QWJ plumbing to light push-pull amplifier that was popular at the time. And so I could tell that various people at ARL were skeptical about this until Ed Tilton came along and said, stop worrying, this thing works. I've been hearing people using it. Over to you, Mel, KQLAW.
KC2QAQ.
Go ahead, Glenn. Is it close to 12 inches?
It says the longest element is 13.75. I don't know, maybe it's because I'm on HF all the time and looking at everything up there, but every time I go back and I look up at that antenna, it looks to me visibly from the ground at 35 feet is 4 inches. But no, actually the longest element is 13.75, but even still, it's a very small antenna, even though it's a 13-foot boom. But, I mean, compared to all my HF stuff, the thing is like nothing, and it's amazing performance. But, yeah, you're right on, Dick. It's around a foot across.
Yeah, that's the reflector and driven element, and some of the early directors are going to be very close to 12, and the most forward director is going to be 11.8 or something like that. Mel, what's the next mailbag?
Okay, yeah, I looked through the QSC, just thumbed through it. Looked at your article again, Dick. 1972, you're right, in April 1972. All right, very good. Oh my God, a lot of years went by. See, you're in the same groove as I am and stuck in the same place, living in the same place also, at 1972. What has come up now, and in fact, it was mentioned today on the 10 meter net in the morning that I have the 10 meter get together, is questions about the number of hams would like to know if anybody on frequency. One gentleman did join us. He built this Elecraft K3, which has gotten some fabulous write-ups in the QSC. And previous to that, they had, of course, the K2, which is a total kit. And they'd like to know if, you know, how much skill and how much time do you think is required to put such an item together. Do you or anyone on frequency have any knowledge of building such a K2 kit? Over.
I do know that the total number of kits issued in the area is probably a little bit small because they were heavily backordered. And people around the world were so happy with the K2 that when the K3 came along, they placed their orders even before the design was completely ready for manufacture. I'm not sure that the amount of time it takes to build it is a big factor. There's one guy who likes building a kit, and the fact that it takes a long time doesn't bother him. Another guy is building the kit simply because he wants to save money and wants to get it over with. The way most of these kits, like Heath Kit and Elecraft, are built, it is made to be reasonably foolproof. In other words, you don't have to be a watchmaker with a high-power microscope in order to be able to do the work. So, as long as the guy can solder, and even if he can't, that's a skill you can learn. I don't think skill requirements should be a gating item. I don't think assembly time should be a gating item. It's a respected kit. Even if you make a couple of mistakes, there's various ways you can bail yourself out of those mistakes. About the worst thing a person could do is make the mistake of using acid-core solder instead of rosin-core solder. and a person who's a plumber by trade may have in his toolbox acid core solder. And yes, that can create a lot of grief. But every assembly kit will way up front give you a whole bunch of warnings to make sure you don't do that. So, as I see it, the exact amount of anticipated man hours, and maybe the website will tell you, but I don't think that should be a gating item. And the skill requirement, as I said, I don't think should be a gating item. What do you think about that, Mel? KQKEY, KQRIW.
Email Delta 2, Bravo Delta, John, a K2 builder from 2003.
Go ahead, John. Tell us everything you know.
I was going to say, ask me any question you want. Well, I built the K2 with 100-watt version back in 2003. The base unit, which ran 15 watts without the 100-watt amplifier on the top of it, took me about 8 days to put together. And that had the single sideband capability, noise blanker, 160-meter band, and it worked right off the bat. I spent a little bit more time building the 100-watt amp because when I first put it together, I was having so much fun with the 15-watt level. I felt that unless I told people I was running 15 watts, nobody really knew. K2RW in the TechNet from KB2BD.
QBZ, a K2 builder from last week.
BZ, we're going to get to you in a second. John, what's your gut feel for the skill level required to be able to put that kit together? Go ahead, John.
It's very similar to an old Heath kit, step-by-step process. I was impressed by a couple of things. One was that all the resistors in the kit are all in a, they're all taped together, kind of like a ladder. And they're all put together in the sequence that you need them to build the kit, so you're pulling one off at a time. It makes it very nice. I thought it was a very nice touch. But other than that, the test equipment is built in. The frequency counter, voltmeter, things like that you need for alignment are kind of built into the kit itself. The front LCD display acts as a frequency counter and voltmeter. But, of course, I did it that way, and then I actually used some more sophisticated test equipment to align it. But other than that, real easy. K2RW and a TechNet from KD2BD.
Very, very fine, John. Thank you for that information. I don't have the full call letters, but Mr. BZ, give us your full call letters and name and your comment. I think you said you built the K3. Go right ahead.
KB1QBZ, Quebec Bravo Zulu. Name is John. I just finished building a K2. It's the basic K2 plus the 100-watt amplifier and the auto tuner. As somebody who built Heath kits back in the 60s and 70s, I would say that this requires a bit of skill, something you could gain by doing a couple of smaller kits first, but I don't think it's appropriate for somebody who has never built a kit before. It's some rather fine work because you're talking about much smaller components than a Heath kit ever used. You're talking about a double-sided printed circuit board where some of the components get tight. These guys did the L-Craft guys did a very, very good job of sequencing the build so that you're not usually having problems with getting very, very tight, but there are some places where you do. There are places where you're putting together cables that are just a real bitch to put together. And there's a lot of toroid winding, where you've got very fine wires that you're winding around a toroid. That can be overcome because there's a guy who's approved by L-Craft who will make the toroids for you. I built a K1 first. I wound my own toroids. After that, I swore off that. I bought all the rest of my toroids from this guy. But it's not something that I would do right off the bat, having never done one before, especially because of the small size of the components and the tight conditions under which you're working. Over.
Very fine, John, number two. Sounds like as a very first kit, you're saying you'd be a little bit skeptical unless the guy is known to have some pretty good manual dexterity and soldering skill. The outsourced guy who builds the toroids for you, what's the approximate price of that service, John?
The toroids, the total of all the toroids for the K2, including the auto tuner, the 100 watt, the noise blanker, the basic kit, I think was somewhere around $100 or $125. I can run downstairs and get the price sheet if you want.
That's close enough. And the whole K2 kit or K3 kit, what's the approximate price of that kit, John?
There's a big difference between the K2 and the K3. The K2 with the 100-watt amp and the auto-tuner is going to wind up running the NSSD, let's see, $7,000. It's about $1,500. I don't remember the exact number. Again, I can get the price sheet. The K3 is typically going to run more in the $2,000, $2,400 range. One thing to bear in mind with the K3 is that there's almost no soldering. It is not a kit in that sense. It's a software-defined radio, and people are spending what they're doing in quote-unquote building it is the software programming. There is essentially no soldering, no physical construction in the K3. Over.
Does the K3 arrive as a series of multi-layer surface mount printed circuit boards that have to be assembled into a case, or are they already into the case and all you have to do is do all the software programming? Over to you, John.
I'm not sure of that, to tell you the truth. My impression is that it arrived as a group of pre-assembled circuit boards that you just plug in simply because it's easier to ship that way, but I don't know. I do know that people spend their time programming it.
Very fine. Okay, back to you, Mel. What's your guess, Mel, from your mail? How many people are thinking of buying one of these Elecraft kits? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Yeah, quite a number of them. Oh, boy, there goes the phone. All right. Maybe it's not for me. Quite a number, Dick. I was amazed at how many questions I've been asked about the K2, K3 series. One of the people that I've talked to about it was W1ZR that writes, you know, Doctors In, and he said what they did. He says if you took a sheet of paper and just looked at the specs on the receiver of either the K2 or K3, you would definitely. Let me just say hello to my daughter. Hold on 1 minute. She's asking to me. Hold on a minute. Must be wanting to tell me. Hold on a minute, please.
Very fine. Looks like Mel will be back in a few minutes. The K2 and K3 kits, the people who are buying the most among the groups that I associate are the guys who are doing serious microwave work where you've got a crystal-controlled converter front end that converts your 1296 down to 2 meters or some lower frequency, and then a tunable IF receiver, an HF like receiver, 80 to 10 meter receiver, does the final tuning and detecting. And what they like about the Elecraft series is that they have high stability, good filtering, extremely high dynamic range, and at least for the K3, I'm not sure about the K2, the ability to be software defined, computer controlled in not only what frequency it tunes to, but what bandwidth and the way the digital signal processing works. That's all software definable. So I think with that software defined, you can determine what kind of filter response you're going to get in the bandwidth determining, what do you call that, noise equivalent bandwidth filter. There's an ideal filter bandwidth for each individual service. And to synthesize that filter with a software-defined technique by digital signal processing gives you the ability to, in theory, tailor a filter so that it acts exactly like a Collins mechanical filter or like somebody else's filter that maybe you've fallen in love with over the years and is no longer available. I don't think you can buy Collins mechanical filters brand new these days. You'd have to buy them on the surplus market. And because there are so many people that just really love that brand name and the performance of that filter, you're likely to pay a significant premium price. And to be able to synthesize that with digital signal processing would give you quite an advantage. That's the way I think I see it going. As I said, the last microwave update that I went to in 2008, I think it was, I remember asking the guys in Philadelphia, from your opinion, how many of the progressive microwave VHF, UHF amateurs 5 years from now, we'll be using software-defined radios and repeater.
Time out.
The answer kept coming back. More than 50% of the progressive amateurs will be exclusively using software-defined radios within 5 years. K2KEY, if you're there. K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Just a quick hello from my daughter. She wanted to say that she was listening in on her scanner there, and says that we're coming in real well tonight in New Jersey. Okay, well, here's the point about the K2, why I guess it's really why a number of people are quite interested. As you heard, the price is for about under $1,500. You can get a radio that, according to, as the gentleman from the ARRL, Joel W1ZR, said, that if you looked at the characteristics of the K2 to K3, just as a receiver, in other words, it doesn't have all the bells and whistles that, of course, are available on many radios today. But ideally, what you want to do, like you just said, Dick, is to listen to one station, get that station, tune that station in as best as possible, and that's what I look for. I mean, I've got a radio now, a high-end radio, has two receivers in it. I don't know what for, because it's hard enough for me to understand what's going on. One receiver, imagine the other ear. I mean, plugging a pair of stereo phones, you can listen to two different frequencies at the same time. For me, that's a little bit, I don't know, not necessarily, at least in my life. Let me let it drop and I'll say a few more words here. Okay, now, according to him, like I say, he writes the article to USB every month, you know, doctors in. He says you laid out the spec sheets on the receiver, and of all the receivers that they have looked into, you know, to review in the last couple of years, this one is up on the top of the list. And so you're looking at a radio, it possibly could be a little involved to put together that, but I guess you could take your time. So far, they seem to be having an extremely high success rate of assembly. And you will wind up with a radio that is performance-wise something that you would have to pay maybe three or four times. I know that may sound something unusual that you're going to homebrew, not really homebrew, but put together a kit that's going to compare to something that's many, many thousands of dollars more, but that seems to be the rule of thumb with the claims on it, Dick, over.
When it comes to brand new equipment with all the horns and whistles, all the modern capabilities, I agree. If a person was pinching pennies and he wasn't looking for the absolute best in all performance, it is my belief that you can get an awful lot of bang for the dollar out of used equipment. And a number of the used pieces of equipment that are a classic that people have over the years fallen in love with. On 2 meters, when it comes to a 2 meter all mode, there are certain people like me who just think the Kenwood TS711A, which is what you're listening to right now, as a 2 meter all mode is an awfully nicely built radio. When it comes to tunable IF radios, for people who really like the Kenwood TS440, Kenwood TS840, 940 series, a lot of bang for the dollar. Of the slightly older radios, the poor man's Collins radio is the Drake R4C. Unfortunately, it's a tube radio, but boy, does it have dynamic range and a noise blanker that's out of sight. Unfortunately, the noise blanker is not installed in all the ones you can buy because it was a accessory item that you added to it. So there are certain classic used 80 through 10 meter tunable IF type transceivers, 100 watt class, which frequently can be bought for less than $1,000, sometimes $500, whereas the brand new ones got some extra horns and whistles, but there are very few 100 watt class 80 through 10 meter rigs these days that are under $2,000. I think they're all considerably above that. Maybe you'll correct me on that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger, this is K2KEY. No doubt that there are still some very nice radios still out there that are a few years old. The problem is that the radios, HF radios especially, that are a few years old, seem to still command a fairly good price. And I can well imagine that somebody that was going to go out and buy a second-hand radio to see if I can manage to put together a K2 and for the same price get an up-to-date, highly recommended, state-of-the-art radio, I can see the attractiveness of it, Dick, and of course the joy of putting it together. Plus, you got to remember one factor that really stands out, and that is it's self-servicing. If you have any problems with it, you can repair it if you put it together. These radios, a number of the newer radios today, if something goes wrong, they have to make the trip back to the factory. When they're out of warranty, you'll be amazed at what they can hit you for. It's mind-boggling when I saw some of the quoted prices on ones that I wound up with because it didn't make sense to repair it, Dick, over.
With rare exception, a guy who's crafty or a guy who has access to somebody like Andy, W2CDL, repairing of a used older piece of equipment usually is not a problem. I only know of one case where it turned into a problem, but usually it's not a problem. On top of that, the fact that some of these older rigs that are very well respected and well loved, that their price is still kind of high, even though they're 10 or 15 or 20 years old, is a little bit discouraging for a brand new buyer, a brand new ham. There's one other way of looking at it, though, and that is if you buy one of these used rigs, use it for a year or two, and you think you've outgrown it, and you resell it on the surplus market, it's likely you're going to get 80% or more of your dollars back. It can be an extremely good investment. Some of these older, well-loved rigs really hold up in their value. So, to trade up later on, it's almost like money in the bank, and you're getting a rather low rental charge while you use it before you resell it. So I'm a big believer in used equipment. Maybe I've been lucky, but me and most of the people I know have never been stung with used equipment. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, well, the only thing I will say is manufacturers of the equipment, when you go back to them for parts, if you can find substitutes, but there are certain things that you can't substitute, like one of the experience I had, and I went back to the manufacturer for the part, and they really, as they say, soaked me, really took an extreme advantage, and it was just to the point where I would never recommend their product for that one reason. I told them that. I said, you can quote me. But it was outrageous what they charged me for. I have a good sense of what a component should cost. And this was really outrageous because I could use, you know, similar components for easily to use as an example to, you know, measure it again. So they were outrageous. So this is, in fact, that's why the radio, which was really a brand new radio, in fact, that I did invest in it to fix it. It was a brand new radio out of the box that was damaged, and when they sent it back, the person that sent it back to this company was very honest to tell them what happened, and you'd think that they would have some kind of, little bit of feeling for them, but they didn't. Quoted them a ridiculous price, wound up back in a box, into the closet for a period of number of years, and then I wound up with it, buying it very cheap, Dick, but when I got finished purchasing the parts from the company, it was ridiculous. I don't know even why I tackled it over.
Out of curiosity, ML, was that Kenwood?
You got it.
Yeah. When it comes to ICOM, they are extremely good on holding the hand of the owner. You call up ICOM's office in Belleville, Washington. They'll sell you the parts. You tell them what you need, and they ship the part to you and bill you. They even trust you to send them money later on. Whereas with Kenwood, you order the part from California, it gets shipped to the local dealer, and you have to buy it from the local dealer. It's a multi-step process. And even when you buy it from the local dealer, you got to prove to him that your money is good before he'll hand you the part. It's considerably more difficult to get repair. But Kenwood does build some very nice designs, so some of the time I'm willing to put up with that. I think you told us that in your case the front panel was damaged and you're replacing the liquid crystal display, and that liquid crystal display was a very pricey item. Is that true, Mel? Mel, go ahead.
Well, it just happened. What happened with this radio, this was called the 830, the TS-830. When it was purchased new, it was taken upstate New York and plugged into an outlet that was a regular standard 110-volt type of socket in the wall, but somebody had changed the wiring around in the building and forgot to change, I guess, the socket in the wall, so it wound up the socket looking very innocent, like 110 volts, was a 220. And bang, it took out the primary. The fuse blew, but believe it or not, before it, the fuse let go, it opened up and burnt out the primary of the power transformer. So it wound up, I could say, going back in the box, was shipped back to Kenwood. Kenwood, they told him the story. I can say he happened to be a very honest gentleman. And they quoted him on that radio at that time. Because of that, they just basically quoted him, I guess it was out of warranty or whatever they would quote, approximately, I think he had told me, around 800 change to fix the thing over.
And you're a guy who bought the transformer and replaced it yourself. And my guess is they charged you $400 for that transformer. Is that true, Mel?
Not quite that bad. It was $227 plus shipping, which was some ridiculous shipping amount, plus that carrying charge and everything. The end result wound up $270, $72 or something like that. Whereas that transformer, I told him, I said, it's ridiculous. I said, I got plenty of power transformers around. I just don't have one that size, you know, that will fit in there. And other than that, I said, because I said, I could put a power supply here together just literally out of my junk box if I want to make an external supply. And nothing. They just didn't want to know from it, really, Dick. Unbelievable the way they treated me at the time when I spoke to them. So I said, okay, believe me, I'll never recommend your product. But the only reason I took it on, I felt sorry for the gentleman and everything, and he's moving and all, so I bought it from him cheap. And then I don't know, because it was still in the box and everything like that. When I ordered it, I didn't even ask the price of the part, figuring it, whatever it is, it's worth it, take over.
And if I know you, you considered rewinding that transformer. And when you tried taking it apart, it was a very difficult to disassemble, potted assembly, is that true? With new metal shield around it?
And more than that, transformer wasn't put together with screws. It was welded, had these welded bands around it, you know, these steel band, like a steel wire that they thread through it and then welded. You couldn't really take that transformer the way it was made. I told them that. I said, this transformer was made like transformers that I know, and I could take the case apart. I said, believe me, I would easily rewind the primary of it or whatever, because I've done that, of course, many times. By the way, Collins mechanical filters are in a new form that they're in right now are still available. Many of the manufacturers of right now, transceivers, still offer mechanical filters. Take over.
Awful glad to hear that. I presume they're around 8.9 or 9 megacycles, and a single mechanical filter by Collins, is that about a $150 item?
I'm not sure. Yeah, I believe around a quarter or so for the newer radios. And still are very popular, the 2.1 for sideband, the 500 for CW. And I believe they're also offering the 250 for CW now. So no doubt they still have a lot of popularity, because once you use a mechanical filter, there's no doubt that you fall in love with it, because it sounds so clean, everything on it, you know. It doesn't have that.
You know, DSP and all these other things are great, but for some reason, I don't know, my ear can't get adjusted. Sometimes some of that ringing is decked over.
Yes, I've heard that. There are a very small number of carefully designed digital signal processing systems which can come close to simulating the Collins mechanical filter and its lack of ring. But they'll have to do some searching. It's not the usual off-the-shelf item, so to speak. Okay, what's the next item in your mailbag, Mel?
Okay. Oh, I got antenna questions. They're coming in from every direction here with antenna ideas to, you know, to hook up all kinds of connect up all kinds of systems and whatnot. Here's one. If I go ahead, instead of using a quarter wave vertical for 15 meters, so you want to put a 15 meter quarter wave, instead of using that, because of my radio problem here, can I make a half wave vertical and not worry so much about radio? That's a good question. Stick a half wave vertical up and feed it at the bottom. I would assume that you could feed it with what would I feed it with? I don't know. I'm just thinking. What do you think, Nick? Over.
Not only can he do it, Mel, he should do it. You and I have been saying now for a couple of months that the person who puts a quarter wave ground plane antenna in his backyard, where if he really wants full performance, he's going to lay down something like 32 radial wires in the lawn. A lot of construction. And take some real estate to be able to do that. A simple vertical dipole. If you've got a high enough support to hold it up in the air, even if you've got to load it with end-loading capacitors and loading coils and zigzagging it because you don't have enough altitude. But a true half-wave vertical antenna is going to give you a hell of a lot more performance because there is no better way to make a counterpoise than a quarter wave of another open-circuited monopole, the other half of the dipole, so to speak. A half-wave dipole is really a pair of quarter-wave ground plane antennas back-to-back. And when you do it back-to-back, you don't need the counterpoise in the middle anymore. You get very high efficiency, very high performance, depending on the height of your support structure. It's higher above the ground, going to give you a lower elevation angle. I'm amazed that of all the simple antennas that we read in the books, that the half-wave vertical is not further emphasized. Every half-wave dipole you ever see in the book is the horizontal one parallel to the ground. They never show you the vertical one. And I think everyone rejects, let me drop this. They reject the vertical one because they think it's going to be difficult to put the feed line in the center and bring the feed line off at a right angle. You don't absolutely have to bring the feed line off at a right angle. You can bring it down, off to one side a couple of feet and then down parallel to the lower half of the dipole. It won't kill it, but you'll have a little bit of RF energy on the outside of the coax when you do that. However, a half-wave dipole split in the center, set in the center, is one way of doing it. A half-wave dipole not split in the center, one solid piece of wire, fed from the bottom with reference to ground, is another beautiful antenna. It'll give you extremely high performance. The only catch is that when you feed a dipole from the end instead of from the center, you're feeding something like a 2,000 ohm impedance instead of a 72 ohm impedance. At first that sounds difficult. A very simple step-up coil assembly, an auto-transformer-like thing, a tapped coil, can do it for you. If you take a look at what's inside of a 5/8 wave ground plane antenna on 2 meters or 440 for your automobile, a mag mount, it's a very simple coil in there, and that antenna is being fed from one end. So feeding a half-wave dipole from the bottom end with just this extra little impedance matching device, a tapped coil, is very well documented, not well documented, easy to do, not difficult to design, will give you very high performance. I strongly recommend it. It's an antenna that has never been given a fair shake. In fact, you're using something similar to that with your parabolic half-wave vertical green wire antenna that's in your evergreen tree out in front of your house, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Now, if you went ahead and you took a link to this pipe and